The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Friday Morning Space Show. It's great to be here. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope that you all had a very happy New Year celebration, and it was all that you expected, and safe, and lots of fun. And I even hope that if you're following the bowl games, your favorite football team is winning or has won. And, of course, the metal hits the rubber on Thursday night when Oklahoma and my boys go for the national championship. So we'll see what happens in another few days. For the show, remember, everybody, this is live on Friday. So for those of you who are hearing it Sunday or later on your favorite AM or FM station, you're hearing a replay. Because after it's live, it is recorded and sent up to satellite. And then the AM and FM stations pull it down for play anytime they want, that Sunday or later. So for you listening on your AM and FM stations, the toll-free number and the chat are not available. They're only available during the live show. For everyone else, everything goes for Friday morning, toll-free, chat, and, of course, as always, email. So for getting into the nitty-gritty, the toll-free number for those of you listening on Friday is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring until it can be answered. We'll bring you up on the air just as quickly as possible. So, again, toll-free, 1-866-687-7223. For those of you using chat and wanting to be with us on chat, remember, we use the AOL family. So we're offering you IM, ICQ, or CompuServe. And the screen name is identical for all of these services. One word, Space Show Chat. Please remember, we're trademarked, copyrighted, registered, and you do have permission to download the shows, transfer them, send them, copy them to DVD or memory sticks, whatever you want to do to circulate the programs and get the word out as to why space is important. You can reference the shows, quote from them, and cite them. My only requirement for that is that you provide a realistic and correct academic citation for any quotes that you take out of the show, and you should be able to put the time interval on that quote so that people will know exactly where it is in a 90-minute or two-hour show that you're taking data from. And that's how you do an academic quote. And if you really don't know how to do that for an online radio show, send me a note, and I'll be happy to email you back how you would do it for some of the various formats used in term paper or thesis or otherwise footnote and endnote citation services from the different organizations. We have a listing of how that would be done for the Space Show. Please remember to check out our newsletter, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com. The website newsletter is comprehensive, has all the details of the show and the future events of the program, and it's where we make announcements and change things if we need to. So check it from time to time. Again, you can't miss it. It's right on our homepage. And then we have the short form of the newsletter available by email. One or two lines about the week's program. That's all. It's designed not to clutter up your inbox. If you would like to subscribe to that, send a note to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, free of charge, no registration, no login. You can listen to the shows from the website, or you can freely download them. And go back and listen to many of these from 2001. There, some are really historical and great information. A lot of people use them for research writing. And, of course, they do the citation and the references. So it's a great resource. I hope all of you can make use of them and use them. We have a store on our website, and also you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation. It is a huge undertaking to deal with this show and to do it and to keep all of our archives available free of charge. So we do need your support, and we thank all of you who have supported us and will be supporting us. It's what keeps the program going. Please remember, the Space Show is brought to you in part by Secure World Foundation, which promotes cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, you can visit their website, secureworldfoundation.org. Remember, we're in Twitter, MySpace, and Facebook. Just a few hold the dates. The AIAA big meeting is coming up next week, January 5th through the 8th in Orlando. It's the Aerospace Sciences Meeting with the New Horizons and Aerospace Exposition. Check it out at AIAA.org. January 27th to the 29th is the 4th Ilan Ramon International Space Conference. It's in Herzliya, Israel, sponsored by the U.S. Embassy and Israel. Sweden in Stockholm on January 29th has the Planetary Society Volunteer Network Meeting. You can Google for that and find it. Astrofest 2009, February 6th through the 7th. It's in the Kensington part of London, England. Check it out at astronomynow.com. Spacefest 209, San Diego, February 19th through the 22nd. Their website, novaspace.com. The SPESIF conference is Huntsville, Alabama, February 24th through the 27th. And we'll stop right there for conferences. So today, I would like to welcome Dan Adamo to the program. He is a graduate of the University of Rochester and the University of Houston. From 79 to 2008, he was employed as a contractor at JSC, Johnson Space Center. Throughout that interval, he was involved with the space mission trajectory simulation design and operations. Beginning in 1990, he supported 60 space shuttle flights from Mission Control's Flight Dynamics Officer Console. In July of 2008, he retired from regular employment to pursue astrodynamics research and consulting tasks full-time, and he participates in educational outreach activities, and we're going to be talking with Dan today about his Lunar Surface Rendezvous mission. I do have a couple of papers that I can send to you if you request them by email. I'll be happy to send them both to you, or you can get them directly from Dan, because he does put out his email address, which is adamod@earthlink.net. You can get them from him as well. Dan, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Oh, just great, David. Thank you very much for access to your forum here. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's an honor to have you on the show, and given that Jim Logan referred me to you, it's even a greater honor. What is the Mission Control Flight Dynamic Officer's Console? What did you do over at Johnson?
Well, the Flight Dynamics Officer Console, referred to as FIDO by the other members of the flight control team, is in charge of trajectory management for, in this case, the space shuttle, although we, the FIDO tradition goes all the way back, I believe, to even the Mercury days. In that capacity, the FIDO is responsible for tracking the shuttle, knowing where it is at any point in time, and then computing the maneuvers required to make it go where we want it to go in the mission, all the way through to landing.
Do you miss it?
Oh, yeah. I had a lot of good experience, but it's kind of hard to not regard that as the peak of one's career in terms of really being involved in day-to-day space operations. It's hard to beat.
I have read your papers on the Lunar Surface Rendezvous mission, which you have, I don't want to say created, but you have certainly modified from what NASA is planning to do. Let's start at the beginning. NASA is planning, assuming they have the funding and that the program is committed to with the new administration, to get us back to the surface of the moon. How are they planning to do it? And then tell us how that differs from what you're talking about. And, you know, I frankly don't understand this four-day, you know, requirement built in where you have to launch both vehicles or the mission is scrubbed even though you've already launched one vehicle. I don't understand the common sense of putting that kind of a mandate on NASA, because they often can't, you know, launch for a variety of reasons, many not the fault of NASA, in that kind of a short-term window.
Oh, absolutely. That is certainly a concern I share in the white paper, and I know a lot of other folks in and out of NASA share that concern. The four-day window is for these two launches is very much driven, I believe, by physics, low-temperature physics, principally, where we are launching a Earth departure stage into low Earth orbit. We may do it at the beginning or the end of that four-day period. The current plans, I believe, are to launch the crew actually first on an Aries 1 into low Earth orbit, and then they would rendezvous with this Earth departure stage. Forgive me for degenerating into acronyms, but we'll just call that the EDS for short. They have to rendezvous with that EDS such that the cryogenic propellant, the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen in that EDS, has not boiled off to the extent where it has insufficient capacity to generate the change in velocity necessary to send the crew and the lunar lander vehicle off toward the moon from low Earth orbit.
And what do you do that's different? Did you do this while you were actually still at Johnson, or is this all after you have retired?
Let me give you a little background on this. Lunar surface rendezvous is nothing new. In fact, there's a citation in my white paper from, 2002 timeframe for Mike Griffin talking about lunar surface rendezvous to an audience in the University of Wisconsin. And I came up with the idea of reawakening the lunar surface rendezvous concept because in developing the Ares 1 rocket, NASA ran into a number of performance challenges that caused two things to happen. First, they had to take some mass off of the payload to accommodate the Ares 1 difficulty. And, of course, the payload is the crew exploration vehicle, also known as Orion. In reducing that mass, of course, run into some difficulties. You know, you may not be able to provide a braking system so that you can land on the ground when you return to the Earth. There's some, you know, a number of issues have developed about what do we take off of that payload. And then the other way to mitigate the performance problems on Ares 1 is to uprate the Ares 5. The Ares 5 winds up taking a much larger load than was originally conceived back in 2005, 15% larger from what I can reckon. And that causes us to put a lot more propellant and all onto the lunar surface access module, which is also known as Altair. And it's now to the point where that Altair looks an awful lot like what I remember from the Apollo days when we were planning to just directly go to the moon, not do any rendezvous associated with the lunar mission, but just send the huge rocket to the moon, land there, and then come home with no dual vehicles involved at any point. It's two stories tall right now, the Altair. And so I started thinking, well, why don't we modify that really simplistic direct descent and return concept and instead evolve it into this lunar surface rendezvous concept, which I first heard about maybe 10 years ago. And it's a great spin-off kind of architecture from the more simplistic direct defense, in the sense that use multiple launches to emplace whatever resources you need on the lunar surface, the destination, to the point where return becomes possible, even if you land with your tanks essentially empty with the crew. And so that's the inception of where I jumped off from the current architecture, where you have rendezvous with the current architecture in low Earth orbit. Then build a vehicle basically in low Earth orbit that you send to the moon, and then you detach part of that vehicle, land on the moon, then re-rendezvous after you've spent your time on the moon with the mothership, discard the lander portion that has been involved in getting to and from the moon's surface, and now you're in low lunar orbit and you need to return home. And this, the rest of this part of the mission, the second part of this mission, minus the construction in low Earth orbit, is very much like Apollo. Just Apollo with a Earth orbit rendezvous tacked on the front end. So folks that are familiar with the Apollo architecture are 90% of the way to being familiar with what NASA advocates for returning to the moon.
As an aside, when I was at the Cape last month for STS-126, I did have the opportunity to meet with quite a few people from NASA who were not happy with the RE1 problem and the way they're resolving it. But what they told me was that this uprating of the RE5 has turned into a nightmare for them too, because the rocket is so big that there is no existing infrastructure that supports it, that it's way too big and too heavy for the existing buildings to work on it, that they're trying to reduce the mass of the rocket and its size by over 2 million pounds to try to make it handable. That's not a great word, but you know what I mean.
Yes.
You know, to so that they can even work with it, that even the pad, there is no infrastructure to support anything this big, both in terms of mass and in terms of physical size, and that its size is really overkill for what is needed, and it's a lousy way to compensate for a rocket that shouldn't be built, which is Ares 1, in their opinion. So I got told that by a lot of people, and you're saying adding 15% to it sort of corresponds with what I've been told.
I'm not surprised. Yeah, some of the stories I've heard is that the VAB, the Vehicle Assembly Building, where we stack shuttles and used to stack Saturn V. And
can't support it.
Yep, we'd presumably stack the Ares 5. We just can't roll it out the door. It's literally too tall. There have been some ideas that, well, maybe we'll leave the launch escape rocket at the very top off of the Ares 5, if indeed we ever put a crew exploration vehicle on top of it, where we would need such a launch escape rocket, that we would actually leave it off, roll it out, and then put it on in the open air, where we wouldn't need to extend that height of the building any further.
Yeah, and I was told that the structure of the building can't support the mass of Ares 5.
Well.
Something's got to give, but, my hunch is that with the new administration, there'll be some type of a stand down and a reevaluation and examination of the whole program. And, unless Mike is kept on as administrator, and his terms seem to be for being kept on, is that you do it my way or don't keep me on, I suspect he will be replaced. And who knows what will happen. Why does NASA not embraced, this concept? What is behind their push to do it their way, which seems unnecessary, expensive, hard, and really risky?
Well, I've been trying to understand that. That involves a lot of speculation, being outside of NASA particularly, but even before I retired, I was trying to understand better the decision back in 2005 after the Exploration Systems Architecture Study report was published, because there's a lot of information in that report. In fact, I cited at several points in my white paper, because it's some of the most detailed technical information available to the public, still, even 4 years plus later. But unfortunately, it's very lean on rationale. It presents a bunch of options that they studied, and then it goes and says, okay, and we selected this one, and for these reasons we selected it, but it doesn't really give the flip side to that rationale, why the others didn't stack up as well. And it just left it, sort of speculating as to why they didn't make other decisions than the ones that were made.
Have you or has anyone calculated the probability of success in launching the second vehicle within that four-day window?
I like to think that if it hasn't been done, there'll be a number of what I call paper simulations to do just that, where you could take statistically what the weather's doing, or even play today's real-world weather and play those games against the requirements for launching, as well as expected reliabilities of systems components that could fail and scrub the launch and all that kind of thing. So although I'm not familiar with what the probability is, I would think that it's something that either has been done and not published or something that could be done well before we ever start flying.
Roger sent in an email from San Diego, and he says, does your approach save time and money? Those seem to be two key factors that the next administration will be considering as they try to determine what to do with the vision for space exploration.
Well, I believe it does save time and money. Let me talk about time, first of all. We're probably talking development time here. You only have one launch vehicle with lunar surface rendezvous. The Ares 5 or some heavy lift vehicle that sends very similar payloads to the moon surface. They have the same descent propulsion system to make the landing on the moon. The only difference is really from one launch to another is whether the crew is sitting on top of the stack or not. The other matter is that because the crew always reside in the crew exploration vehicle. They don't go off to a lunar lander or anything like that. Then you don't have to develop this other crewable system, the lunar surface access module with its cabin in the ascent stage and all the special components that go into that vehicle as well. So not only do you have you avoided developing Ares 1, there may be other reasons to develop it, but certainly not for lunar exploration. Under this new architecture. You also have avoided developing anything but the descent stage of the Altair lunar lander. So that saves time. And then expense, well, there's some expense, of course, associated with all that development. But even though it looks on the surface like, under lunar surface rendezvous, you're launching two Ares 5s, well, that's more expensive than an Ares 1 and an Ares 5 required under the current architecture. But there's huge economies of scale, procedures, commonality, all kinds of payoffs from not having to support two launch vehicles with two dissimilar payloads. And I think that's something that really bears some looking into. I'm no economics expert, but from what I know of operation in the space program, this is a huge payoff.
So if... in the new administration, they scrapped Ares 1 and decided that they would use a heavy Delta or Atlas, which Reuters is reporting this morning as well, in a merging of DOD and NASA programs. Basically, in Lunar Rendezvous that you're talking about, using a Delta or an Atlas would not be necessary either.
That's true, too. Of course, there's a lot of concern about what's known as the gap between when the shuttle gets retired and when we develop some other crewable system that can take us into low Earth orbit for logistics, crew logistics specifically, to the space station. But I would hope that with the Russian partnership that we have been engaged in for over a decade now, together with the commercial off-the-shelf program where we're going to develop commercially vehicles capable eventually of putting crews into low Earth orbit and rendezvousing with space stations. I would hope that those would be alternatives to having to crew rate an expendable vehicle. But all those alternatives to Ares-1 are certainly viable and on the table right now, I hope.
Ted in Albuquerque says, since you were at Johnson, what's your own opinion on whether shuttle should be kept flying? We know it's not economical, but nothing that NASA is going to build is going to be economical. So I take that argument off the table. Can the shuttle be flown additionally to avoid the gap, and can it be flown safely?
Well, I believe that it can. Safely is sort of a subjective term. I believe the shuttle is an inherently more dangerous vehicle than concepts like Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, and CEV. But given what we know about the system, having flown it for decades now, I think we know how to manage that risk over a limited number of flights. And if it makes sense to continue flying the shuttle past the year 2010, and I think they're talking like fiscal year 2010, so you know, get down into all the nitty-gritty about, okay, that's, you know, off there into October 2010, you would stop. Then I think that is a manageable risk that we could take if it was justified. I'm sure there are people willing to fly on the shuttle, but I don't think it's a good idea to keep flying a system that is showing its age and has demonstrated its inherent riskiness any longer than necessary. I hate to give an unclear answer there, but it's a very much a political answer when you get down to it, because we know what the risks are, I think, and it's just not a cut and dry kind of answer when we stop flying this thing. It has unique capability. Is one heck of a flying machine, but it's risky at several points in its flight profile.
We are certainly going to miss it whenever it retires.
I know I will.
Absolutely, because none of this has the kind of capability that shuttle brings to the table.
Absolutely.
Barbara in Boston says, I'm really not quite sure I'm understanding some of your program. If we went to what you're proposing, there is no transitional injection orbit to the moon. We're going straight from Earth to the moon, and the same with the return. We're coming back directly from the surface of the moon back to Earth.
Yes, Barbara, I really haven't outlined what I'm advocating very well. Let me just quickly review the flight profile with David's permission, if that's
sure. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. What we are talking about here is an initial Ares V launch into low Earth orbit. This initial launch would have no crew, just purely cargo. The cargo consists of, or the payload consists of, what I call a return consumables module, an RCM, that sits on top of a descent module. The descent module is sort of like a scaled up descent stage for the lunar surface access module. And they sit on top of the EDS, and then without any rendezvous, the EDS lights up after you check out the payload, see that it's spaceworthy, lights up and sends the payload to the moon, and the descent module puts the return consumables module into lunar orbit and then lands it on the lunar surface at some desired location.
And this is all remote.
And this is all done, yeah, as a uncrewed, remote piloted vehicle. I'm not even sure that when you talk about actually landing on the moon that you could even call that remote piloting. You'd have some kind of autopilot on board. But one thing to remember is we know and will know even more about lunar surface obstacles. We'll have a huge database that Apollo never even could touch in terms of how rugged terrain is, right down to sub-meter kind of resolution, so that we won't be just, you know, shooting in the dark like Apollo would have had to, or like Surveyor, the initial precursor missions for Apollo that were uncrewed. That we just basically blindly landed on the moon and knew little more than where the lunar surface was, not any obstacle. So this thing would land on the moon. It would be checked out to make sure that all its systems were functional. One of the systems that I'm really high on would be some type of NAV-8 system, you know, with a radar or optical beacon that would aid any subsequent landings nearby to come down with absolute precision. You would know exactly, you know, what leg you were landing next to with respect to the vehicle already on the moon.
Hold it. Let's hold it there. We're taking our first break because I hear the music. We'll be back, everyone, 2 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of The Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Dan Adamo today on The Space Show. We are talking about Lunar Surface Rendezvous. He has two papers that he has sent me. I'll be glad to send them to anybody that sends me an email and requests them. And we're in the process of having him clarify how we get to and from the moon using LSR, as he has written about in his paper. So we just landed the remote package from launch number one on the surface of the moon, and it doesn't matter where on the moon we're going, or this works no matter what target has been chosen.
Thanks, David. Yes, it works no matter where, and that's another motivating factor in this architecture, is that it's trying to really live up to the land anywhere, leave anytime mantra that was originally required of our lunar surface exploration. And so we land a vehicle on the moon in any location under this, which is going a step beyond Apollo, has been called Apollo on steroids on occasion. And then we can stay there as long as we like, or leave anytime we need to if there's an emergency. And with this architecture, there's no big variations in the amount of propellant required to pull that off. To land anywhere, leave anytime, with pretty much flat propellant requirements. So you don't have to overload propellant tanks with emergency gas that you never really intend to use, but you may have to, but you don't really know. And all that is, in my opinion, a really difficult operational situation. And the shuttles, in my experience, that got into those kind of situations, it was just not a really strong mission concept anytime we even considered that kind of thing. So it's something I wanted to map into our lunar exploration architecture. So let's press on from this point. We've got a essentially all that we need to get home with on the lunar surface waiting for the crew to arrive, and it's all checked out. And we don't even launch the crew until we've achieved that milestone. And we can launch the crew up to 6 months after this initial payload lands on the moon. And I say 6 months because that's pretty much the state of the art in storing propellant like what we are envisioning for the return trip. So we can store, we know from space station experience, we can store that kind of propellant for about 6 months, and no problem. So up to 6 months after the first Ares 5 launch, we launch another Ares 5, and this one has a crew on top of it. It's otherwise an identical launch vehicle, including the descent module that the crew needs to land on the moon. Once that vehicle is checked out in low Earth orbit, then the Earth departure stage lights up, sends it toward the moon, and the descent module then performs a lunar orbit insertion burn and lands the crew exploration vehicle right next to the return consumables module at the lunar landing site that we want. At that point, we engage in lunar surface operations with the crew doing its scientific mission, and then also in parallel, some type of robotically controlled consumables transfer takes place between the return consumables module and the crew exploration vehicle. At landing, the crew exploration vehicle has a very small propellant load equivalent to a change of velocity capacity of about just under 900 meters per second that would be used for abort maneuvers and other contingencies. But otherwise, it just lands with that propellant and then gets topped off on the lunar surface. So that occurs in parallel with the crew's activities. And then the crew exploration vehicle is free to launch at any time once it's topped off. And it can also launch in any direction from the landing site. Does not require any rendezvous in low lunar orbit. It's completely free to launch in a direction that places it in a position to leave for the Earth an orbit or so after it launches, goes around the moon to the proper geometry to achieve that maneuver. And then it has a, you know, 3-day trip back, sort of standard transit to the Earth. And the timing is probably geared in terms of the return trip, the timing is geared toward what longitude you'd like to land at. So if the Earth is rotated to the proper inertial orientation that it has the landing site roughly opposite where you departed from the moon. This is all very much more simple than the geometric constraints associated with the current architecture because they are driven by having to do rendezvous in low Earth orbit and rendezvous in low lunar orbit. Something that's possible wasn't necessary to do any low Earth orbit rendezvous for Apollo, but we certainly pulled off low lunar orbit rendezvous, but under very much more severe constraints in terms of where you were going to land and how long you were going to stay there. Those constraints are, to the best of my knowledge, no longer applicable because we're playing a much more flexible game at the moon, landing anywhere, leaving anytime.
Speaking of leaving anytime, Carl in Memphis sent in this note. And again, listeners, you can use the toll-free line. Let me give it out to you again, 1-866-472-2. 687-7223. Carl in Memphis says, I thought the purpose of our returning to the moon was return to stay, to put an outpost on the moon to keep people there. So why are we talking about leaving the moon in the first place? Or are we talking about crew rotation leaving the moon after maybe 6 months of being on the moon or something like that? I really don't know what the time period for crew rotation would be. But if all we're doing is footprints on the moon again and leaving a few days later, we're not going to be any better off when this program ends, and it will end, than we were with Apollo.
Well, that's a very good question. NASA, to the best of my knowledge, is still carrying two types of missions to the moon, two types of mission on the lunar surface. One is an outpost mission, where we're talking about rotating a crew or providing consumables to a more or less permanent location on the moon. And, of course, we've been hearing a lot about near-polar locations with regard to where an outpost would be positioned. There's a lot of advantages to those polar locations. I won't go into those unless there's further questions if people want to know about them. But obviously we would want to rotate crews at that remote location certainly no more frequently than we do with the International Space Station. So once every 6 months is a good working number. You know, the interesting thing about outposts is that you've got to do the same kinds of things that we're talking about with lunar surface rendezvous. Simply because the outpost is there all the time doesn't free you from the obligation that you've got to be able to land consumables next to it and resupply the outpost with those consumables. So it sounds an awful lot like the return consumables module, only you're pumping consumables into a lunar surface location as opposed to a return vehicle. So the outpost requirements on logistics have a lot to do with what we're worrying about in terms of lunar surface rendezvous. In effect, that's what you're doing, just to keep the outpost going and rotate crew.
What is the other type of mission NASA's carrying on the books?
The other type of mission is called the sortie. And scientifically, I think people are more interested, scientists, particularly planetary scientists, are actually more excited about that mission than the outpost, because to get to new territory, new geologic formation, from an outpost, you're talking about progressively longer and longer trips in some type of roving vehicle across the lunar surface. That roving vehicle, you know, if you're talking 100 kilometers or more across the lunar surface, it could be susceptible to some very nasty scenarios, such as mechanical breakdown and solar storms if it's not sufficiently shielded. You're obviously putting the crew at some increasing risk with range from the outpost. So the idea is, with the sortie mission, is land at locations all over the moon to study the moon's geology, but you don't intend to stay there. In fact, you may never come back again. So the idea is to land, stay for about a week, and then depart. And those sortie missions drive the current architecture into some very undesirable vulnerabilities, because 1 week, think about what is a lunar month, a lunar orbit period around the Earth. Well, that's about a quarter of a period, a quarter of a month. And quarter periods cause all kinds of planar geometries to develop in setting up the return, both the rendezvous with the mothership and the return to Earth, that are extremely undesirable. And I can go into those more if we want to.
We probably will in one of the later segments, but what about radiation advantages or disadvantages for the crew? Does what you propose offer any less exposure for radiation risk, or is that a push whichever way you do it?
I like to think it does, simply because we tend to have to design the crew module for return to Earth, the CM in the CEV, We have to design that with a lot more mass and robustness, because it's got to take not only launch stresses, but the entry stresses on return. So there's a need to design a lot more loads bearing strength and mass into the crew module than you would the lunar module, or the lunar surface access module, the Altair. And that was certainly true in Apollo. I don't know exactly where we're going to wind up in terms of radiation shielding with the Constellation vehicles we're talking about for the future, but in Apollo, there's no doubt that the lunar module, you could kick your foot through it. The command module, you could not. And so if you're bringing the command module, the crew module in the case of Orion, if you're bringing it down onto the lunar surface, you probably have, particularly in a sortie mission where there's no other safe haven on the surface awaiting you, you probably have the best solar storm cellar that side of low Earth orbit working for you right handy there on the lunar surface if a solar storm develops. Now, it's probably arguable that we know how to predict solar storms with a great deal more precision than we did back in the Apollo days, where the crew actually could get caught totally unawares on the lunar surface with insufficient time to reach the shelter of the command module before as a solar storm struck. We probably can do a considerably better job of predicting solar storms erupting and save the crew, but you might not save the mission if you had the crew down on the lunar surface needing to get back to the mothership in lunar orbit under the current architecture. You would be having to pretty much abort the lunar surface mission. Whereas if the crew module was on the surface, you might have to curtail activities on the surface for a few days, but you wouldn't be aborting the mission totally. So I like to think that putting the crew module down on the lunar surface, although a lot of people say, well, that's a waste, you know, you're putting all that mass of parachutes and things you need to come back to the Earth, heat shield, those kinds of things down on the lunar surface. That's true, that's undeniable, but you're also putting a great storm shelter down there for the crew to use in the event of a solar storm.
Another email question for you. Jim is in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he says, officially, we're supposed to go to the moon in order to learn how to go to Mars down the road. I'm wondering if your plan can be extrapolated into a way to efficiently, effectively, and safely get to and from Mars, or would the way NASA is talking about be more desirable for Mars?
Well, I'm not sure that the way I'm advocating and NASA's way are that different when it comes to a destination as far away as Mars, because, you know, another thing that's sort of slick about being able to land next to something and resupply yourself with what that something has is maybe even more the case at Mars than at the moon. You know, with the profile I've outlined for Lunar Surface Rendezvous, we're talking about consumables for the return trip that were supplied by the Earth. They're just landed there and waiting for you. With another twist, which is called in-situ resource utilization, ISRU, the consumables for the return trip are actually made on site. You could, for example, make oxygen and liquid oxygen on the moon from the rocks. On Mars, you might be able to make some more efficient propellant like methane from local material. For all I know, that ultimately will be the plan NASA implements for traveling to Mars. And in that case, you're talking about another kind of surface rendezvous architecture where, in this case, the return consumables aren't sent from the Earth ahead of time. They're actually made on Mars ahead of time. So there's that element. Sort of lost my train of thought, but there's other... Now, let me get back to taking it easy between the moon and Mars. That's an awful big step. And there's other destinations that we might consider in transitioning from lunar missions to Mars missions, that are the near-Earth asteroids, specifically near-Earth objects of all kinds, are being discovered at a phenomenal rate. And we already have identified a few candidates off in the 2020s of near-Earth objects that we could actually reach with the kinds of launch vehicles we're talking about today. And the idea of being able to reach those can be extended somewhat, perhaps dramatically, by pre-emplacing resources at those destinations. So if you can think in terms of the destination not being the moon's surface, but some asteroid in a orbit very similar to the Earth's around the sun, then you could probably get to more, certainly could get to more remote locations that eventually might even approach Martian orbit by pre-emplacing your return consumable on those destinations, whether or not you made those consumables on site or transported them from Earth.
What has been your peer reception on your ideas so far? I'm sure this paper has gone out to far more than just the space show. So what's the feedback for you? What are you getting so far on your ideas?
Well, I've had pleasure of conversing with a number of my former colleagues on it informally. Even had a former astronaut comment on it, which I really appreciated because he had some very interesting angles. And generally, what I'm finding is that, you know, if you want to be true to the land anywhere, leave anytime lunar exploration requirement, this probably is a stronger architecture than what we have. I've really run into no showstoppers on it. Certainly there are concerns with it, maybe not the least of which is the transfer of consumables. It's a critical operation. Otherwise, you've stranded the crew on the lunar surface. But as I get into in the white paper, if a crew gets stranded anywhere between the Earth and the Moon, under this architecture, you probably can mount a rescue mission a lot easier than you could under the architecture we're currently carrying officially. That's because what I hear about Launch Complex 39 is that one pad will launch Ares 1s and another pad will launch Ares 5s. And think about it, when you launch that Ares 1, that pad is not going to be very usable if you need to launch another one. Moreover, if the crew gets stranded beyond low Earth orbit under the current architecture, you probably have to launch an Ares 1 and an Ares 5. Turning both pads around is really onerous to do on a short notice. So with the architecture I'm advocating under Lunar Surface Rendezvous, both pads would presumably be able to launch either vehicle configuration. Moreover, the uncrewed vehicle configuration probably can affect the rescue anywhere between the Earth and the Moon's surface. Just, you know, land another return consumables module next to the crew if the first one didn't work out.
This morning when I read the Reuters article about the possible merging in some ways of DOD and NASA, and the transition team even somewhat supporting that. Again, be wary of what you read in the press because you never know if it's accurate or not. But one of the things they said that was motivating all of this was China's effort to go to the moon with people. Do you have any information or knowledge or insight on what kind of methodology China would be using, or Russia or India, because they've all announced a human moon program? If they really did get their act together and committed the money, how would they be going about doing the moon? Would they be doing something like what NASA is proposing, or more or less something on the order of what you've proposed?
Well, up front, let me say I have virtually no information. I can only speculate like everyone else can. Outside of those programs. What little information I have actually deals with Russian plans to send tourists at least into lunar orbit or fly around the far side of the moon. And they're very interesting because they involve utilizing the infrastructure associated with the space station, the International Space Station. I don't know if any of your audience has seen that kind of thing, but they basically would launch a vehicle capable of making it to lunar orbit and have it rendezvous with the space station, possibly obtain some consumables from the space station that would be in place. Then they'd get a crew up there once all that was accomplished, and then leave from the space station heading for the moon. Of course, that is that translunar injection burn that you would do in from the vicinity of the space station is really no more expensive in and of itself than any of the other translunar injections we did in Apollo or are considering doing under Constellation. The price you pay is getting all that mass into the space station's orbit in the first place. That's the real penalty. And once you've paid it, then any of the expenses of getting to the moon from that point on are no greater than any other method you might use. So I don't know if any of the other plans are as well developed as the Russian plan. Of course, the Russian plan relies on vehicles that don't exist yet, still have to be developed.
Hey, that's the way the whole space industry relies on right now,
yeah,
including new space.
It's all vaporware, but where I start bristling is when it's vaporware that uses unobtainium.
But it's got really cool PowerPoints, let me tell you.
I'll bet. Yeah.
You know, maybe you can answer this, because I have had this standing offer out there for all of 2008, specifically to the new space community, but to anyone, if they can calculate the ISP value of a PowerPoint. Is that something you can do for us?
Well, I like keeping my ISPs well under 500 seconds. I don't know about those PowerPoints, but they may be in the thousands.
anything you want to make them, right?
Yeah.
You know, if I were going to go to the moon on that Russian tourist program in a modified Soyuz or the old Zond capsule, they'd have to probably sedate and tranquilize me like hell. I mean, you got to have some room to at least move, I think. That thing is like being in a tuna fish can.
Yeah. Probably a minimum of 6 days, I would think.
Well, yeah, three there and three back to the station, right?
Yep. Even if you didn't want to go into lunar orbit, if you're just doing like a quickie free return, it would be a minimum of 6 days under any kind of conventional propulsion.
I asked you this before we started the show, so I do know that you don't specifically have the right answer for this question, but in, you know, on behalf of the listeners, for them to consider this at some point during all of the planning and talk that NASA is undertaking regarding going back to the moon, that there's going to come a point where they say we have to commit in order to design, build, and test the hardware and the systems to achieve, you know, our goal on X date. And if the date for going to the moon is 2020, what do they need for a typical government program like this? 7, 8, 9 years in advance? I mean, are we approaching a go, no-go point? Does the Obama administration face a go, no-go point? How does this work? I mean, you've been on the inside. You know, give us some insights.
Yeah, I've been in on the inside, although only with one program. The shuttle lasted so long that it pretty much spanned my aerospace career, which is really sad and sad comment in and of itself. It's a shame that we weren't developing other vehicles all along. We sort of started to, but we never really got anything flying, at least with a human crew on board. Yeah, I think your estimate of 6 or 7 years, given that this is not a program like Apollo, I hate to use the word crash program, but in effect, that's what Apollo was. There essentially were no budget limitations. They had the mandate to do whatever it took to get to the moon. And, of course, that had a number of very interesting cultural spinoffs from it that permeated the new NASA at the time in the 60s, where, you know, you just worked those 80-hour weeks and did what it took to learn what previously had not been known and get the job done by hook or by crook. today we have a much more mature culture at NASA. And, people are going to be cautious. We've been bit by not being cautious before, so that sounds like a good way to proceed. And it's going to take longer. And I think even though we have a very good start on the elements of going back to the moon, that how we go back to the moon is going to need to get very mature and well well controlled and frozen, basically, in the very near future, in the next several years, certainly within the first term or so of Obama's administration.
Stay right where you are, Dan. Everybody else, we'll be back in 2 minutes with more on The Space Show.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And The Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Friday Space Show program. Dan Adama won't succeed. Detrimental. You know, their projects. So I'm one idea to the moon. Then two that places Ares 5 and Ares 1 with the Jupiter class rockets, which are more shuttle derived less changes, so probably less problems. But your program doesn't even require the initial Jupiter launch that they have, replacing Ares 1. So I'm wondering if we are able to say, look, we can do the moon program, we can go to the vision, and we can get back to the moon, and you know, here's a method to do it that's much simpler. Can your idea be used that way?
Well, I like to think so, David. I've read some of the direct proposal, reviewed the entire thing, actually, and I find myself taking issue not so much with their launch vehicle proposals as with their architecture again. You know, that's my issue with the current NASA plan to get back to the moon. Isn't so much the launch vehicles. I don't really have a use for Ares 1, but I don't particularly have any issues I'm raising with Ares 1. The real issues I'm trying to raise are architecture related. And in the direct proposal, they gravitate toward very similar architectures to the one that NASA is carrying right now, requiring rendezvous in low Earth orbit with all the geometric constraints associated with it, requiring rendezvous in low lunar orbit with similar constraints. There was one long-term option, as I recall, where they were proposing a lunar surface rendezvous because it helped demonstrate some of the capabilities and uprating potentials that they were hoping to carry going into Martian missions. And so their motivation wasn't the same as what I would advocate, but they did wind up proposing eventually using a lunar surface rendezvous architecture.
NASA claims that when they were looking at the ESA's architecture, that they considered direct and a whole bunch of other things. When they are asked about or when they talk about the specifics of going to and from the moon, do they say they looked at lunar surface rendezvous like you're talking about and rejected it because of A, B, and C? Or does that issue just not come up like it comes up for direct?
Well, in the ESAS report, you can probably find in one of their performance sections, I don't recall specifically, but I would be very surprised if you didn't somewhere find lunar surface rendezvous covered. However, as I said before, the rationale for not carrying that forward is not well documented in that report. Rationale is really weak in that report. You know what they're advocating, but you may not know why, and you certainly don't know why they didn't advocate something. So that report really has some problems with me in terms of rationale. But I know from the charts that I cite in my white paper from Dr. Griffin that he's certainly aware of lunar surface rendezvous and certainly raised in those charts some of the upsides and downsides associated with it.
Lincoln in Alexandria, Virginia, sent in this email, and he said, speaking of that ESA's report, lots of us would like to see Appendix 6. It is somehow classified and not available as a national security document. Do you have any idea why Appendix 6 of that report is a national security classified document and cannot be obtained with the rest of the ESA's architecture reports?
No, I sure don't. I could only speculate like anyone else, and I really wouldn't be willing to do that. I have no idea. It just doesn't sound like the right thing to do in a civilian space program that's open to free and unfettered criticism and review. So, no, I can't speculate.
I've had a lot of listeners tell me in questions and on the phone that they can't get Appendix 6. And apparently Appendix 6 breaks down the detailed cost analysis of all of these programs and their mechanics, including what might be, you know, talked about as the direct program, although it wasn't under that name. And but nobody seems to be able to get it released, and even under the Freedom of Information Act. So
NASA has been very forthcoming with information under Freedom of Information Act petitions, and that's just really a sad thing. One of the things I would be remiss in not complaining about with this whole process, where we wound up with a current architecture, and where we continue to reject ideas about how the current architecture might be modified, is that I think it goes counter to the culture advocated by the Columbia Accident Investigation Board. One of the big findings in that board's criticism of the NASA before the Columbia accident is that there was not a process, at least in certain circles, decision-making circles in NASA, there was not a process where dissent was invited and listened to. And that's what I see going on with this architecture. I know there's political reasons for pressing on and not changing things, but that doesn't mean you stifle dissent. Contractors should be free to propose alternatives to what we're doing right now, and they ought to be listened to actively, but they certainly shouldn't be stifled. And that's what I'm seeing in the press. I don't know if I should be believing it or not, but I don't see any folks saying, "Oh no, we didn't stop so and so from talking about such and such," because you then see all kinds of press releases from those companies, and we just don't see those.
Well, I do know that a lot of people have told me privately, my friends at NASA, that they don't have freedom to talk. There is, you know, concern about losing jobs. There's all sorts of things like that. There have been reports in the press, whether we want to believe them or not, I guess just take your pick, because, again, I'm not a big believer in accuracy in the media, but except on the space show, of course. But one of the things is that at a recent event, Griffin was there and some of the transition team was there, and they talked about doing, you know, due diligence onto, you know, the ESAS program and how NASA's going to the moon. And Mike is purported to have told them that they're not qualified to look at his rocket vehicle. And you can't go and look under the hood, and you can't investigate anything in NASA, because that demonstrates that you have no trust and confidence in what I'm doing. And so, therefore, it's all off limits. And that's been widely reported, and if that really is the top-down attitude, to say that that is a reenactment of the pre-Columbia mentality would be an understatement.
I think it goes counter as well to NASA's mission, its charter for outreach. You should be willing, as an agency like NASA, to explain what has led you to the architecture you're advocating with taxpayer dollar funding. You should never have any reluctance to do that freely and openly, and then subject yourself to public feedback. That's really my whole point in being here on the space show today, is I want feedback from people. Anyone out there listening, don't hesitate for a minute to get in touch with me if you don't understand something I'm advocating or don't agree with it.
How much of what is in your white paper or your ideas might be ITAR protected, or is what you're talking about pretty common public knowledge?
I think it is, because as someone said in a meeting a few weeks ago, complaints can be directed to email address s.i.newton.edu, cambridge.edu, because it's really just physics. If I was talking about detailed vehicle design, possibly with technology and intellectual property that was very specific and had patents pending or granted, I might be in ITAR trouble. But here I am talking about the laws of physics as they apply to lunar exploration, and how to avoid getting into some very nasty conflicts with those laws.
So, as far as any of us know, the laws of physics are pretty much public domain, right?
Yep. I've compared them with my Russian colleagues over the past decades, and we can't find any deviations.
I should introduce you to some new space friends of mine who think the laws of physics can be bent and massaged. So,
oh, here comes unobtainium again.
Well, what do you think? We have the Google Lunar X Prize, where all of these private companies want to go land a small payload on the moon, robotically, of course, to do something and last for a certain period of time. For them to get to the moon, I know it's different because it's not a human mission to the moon, but they got to be facing the same set of physics, right?
Oh, that's true, but of course they don't have to worry about a round trip. See, that's what really nails us. With all these geometric constraints, is that, oh, you left your return trip home 99% of the way to the destination, but you still have to deal with the geometric constraints imposed by that mothership in low lunar orbit. And you have to deal with the other problems that we have in low Earth orbit. We're trying to bring two vehicles together with two separate launches in less than 4 days, and then depart for the moon. I think probably these commercial enterprises for the Lunar X Prize competition, first of all, I would imagine they don't require any rendezvous anywhere in their profile.
No, it's however you can get there.
Yeah, it's just however you can get there, and I would be really surprised if they needed more lift potential than is offered by the expendable vehicles that they're no doubt going to use. And then it's a one-way trip. So they might have to go into lunar orbit before they land. But they just, you know, get the proper plane that passes over the landing site in doing that maneuver, and then any number of orbits later, whatever operationally makes sense to them, they drop out of orbit and land.
Yeah, the soft landing is an issue. I know that from having talked to several of them. But you're right. They don't have to come back, and of course they don't have people with them.
Right.
Which makes a big difference. Is there any way to effectively simulate what you're talking about here on Earth as a comparison to what NASA is talking about?
Well, that was the point of the second paper, which really the second document I sent you before
the overview of a lunar surface rendezvous mission.
Right. I'm writing a paper in detail about how a mission in 2019 would be conducted under this lunar surface rendezvous architecture. The whole idea is to have a crew landing at a very interesting site that would be very performance challenged under the current architecture, and have them conducting lunar surface operations there on the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11's landing and moonwalk. In doing that design, I'm also going to explore a number of abort options and strategies between launching the crew from low Earth orbit until they land on the moon or commit to landing on the moon. That paper I took and just made a sort of a little travel brochure out of the crew portion of the mission, the nominal crew portion of the mission, so that people can sort of visualize with a number of trajectory plots what is going on, and then I also give an overview of the sequence of events associated with the mission. And those kinds of activities can be done with any number of commercially available programs. I won't do any endorsements. I have my own home-rolled version, homebrewed, that I've been working on for some time away from work, so that there's no intellectual property issues with it. This kind of thing is not any kind of advance in capability given today's personal computer horsepower.
Alice in Lincoln, Nebraska says, why, in your opinion, is it important for us to go back to the moon with people?
Well, The moon is a very convenient first step to getting people out into the solar system and developing the technology necessary to support that. We're only 3 days from home, maybe 4 days if you throw in a little of the overhead and various phasing requirements. So we don't have to worry about radically changing the way we support missions with either rescue or just routine communications, for that matter. There's a little bit of a delay, but no worse than you see on CNN when somebody's reporting from halfway across the world. So the communications issues that you see with, you know, interplanetary time lags of minutes to hours just aren't there. And yet, you're out of low Earth orbit. You're on another object that is scientifically interesting, well-preserved compared to the Earth's weathering processes. So that there's a lot of science to be done on the moon. We barely scratched the surface during the Apollo program. And forces us to develop these kinds of technologies we've been talking about, like propellant transfer on the lunar surface and precision landing next to a vehicle waiting for you there, that we need to develop if we're going anywhere else in the solar system. So it's really fortunate that we have this near-Earth object called the moon in such close proximity. And then we need to recognize that there are other objects between the moon's distance and Mars's distance from the Earth that also serve as great stepping stones as we want to keep stretching things more and more. And then eventually we wind up flying missions to objects a lot like those near-Earth objects, those near-Earth asteroids, that happen to be in orbit around Mars, Phobos and Deimos, the two moons of Mars, are very much like these objects we're talking about between the orbit of Earth and Mars. And from that point, we're in a position to go the final few tens of thousands of kilometers down to the Martian surface, which is a big nut to crack in itself.
I'm going to extrapolate a little bit on Alice's question and ask you the silver bullet question is, why do we even care about a human space program? Why do we have to, you know, get people out into space, go to Mars, and Io, go to the moon? What is there about putting humans in space that is essential for us?
Well, assuming we aren't going so extrapolating to the point where we aren't even acknowledging why we want to be in space, why we want to get knowledge from space, just that we're trying to settle the question of humans.
Yeah, let's just leave it at the human side.
Okay. Humans are, at the current state of the art in robotics, humans are orders of magnitude beyond what we can program and fabricate in terms of the ability to react to unanticipated situations, and not only in a defensive way to react to contingency, but also in a sort of an offensive way to react to unforeseen opportunities, such as the Genesis rock on the moon during the Apollo program. You know, you see that thing that you were looking for, but putting that into a robotic package, some type of program, is really, really beyond the state of the art right now. Now, it's advancing awfully fast, so I can't deny that there's a potential out there for creating some type of cyber intelligence that is so human-like that the need for human beings to be on the scene goes away. But I, you know, that's vaporware. I don't see it yet. We've written my colleagues and I that are advocating near-Earth object exploration. We've written numerous papers on what advantages there are in sending a human being to one of these asteroids that are in a very Earth-like orbit. We could find things that are beyond our wildest imagining in locations like that, which have not seen even the moon's degree of modification since the solar system formed.
So you would advocate a NEO over Mars because of potential discovery of useful material?
I'm not sure I'd advocate it over Mars, but I probably would push for it. I certainly would push for it before we bite off the big piece that Mars represents in terms of a giant leap from the moon to Mars. I think it's foolhardy to just take that one big shot. We need to go cautiously, particularly since the further you get from home, the more susceptible you are to, at least under microgravity conditions, the deterioration that you see in the human organism, as well as the susceptibility to solar radiation and cosmic radiation, for that matter. We need to be really careful we know what we're doing before we send people to Mars.
Well, I would think we need to know what we're doing before we send them anywhere, lest we kill them all.
Even the moon. There's a lot of concern with these radiation sources on the lunar surface that if you think you're going to send a crew to some kind of base for 6 months and have them go out and do science on the lunar surface on a daily basis, they're not going to make it. They're going to be probably in some type of terminal state in terms of their health by the time they return.
We're going to come up on our next break, but I've got an interesting comment that I'm going to see if I can't reword from John in Montana, who is a strong believer in healthy debate and argument, but when it generates into ad hominem tax backbiting, unpleasant and inconvenient truths in politics, it's extremely unhealthy. And then what I'm adding to is, unfortunately, when there isn't even allowed the debate within the organization, especially when it's concerning humans doing something, it goes beyond how it degenerates, according to what John is talking about. So what is the fear of a debate? He says that Mike's approach might work for a really small business, but not some kind of a large organization dealing with very complex issues, and certainly not one that's living off the public taxpayer dollar.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. It just makes no sense at all to me. Yeah, you may want to keep the troops marching, but that doesn't mean you can't have a debate in parallel with that.
Well, I mean, to think that we're paying for my way or the highway mentality is really, you know, not something I want to do with my tax money, although, you know, God knows what they're doing with my tax money. But
you don't want to encourage it.
You don't want to encourage it. And at least in the NASA situation, it's pretty obvious that that's going on. In many of the other areas, we have no clue what they're doing with our tax money.
You know, that's true, but the Accident Investigation Board that said that's not the right thing to do, they held up the U.S. Navy submarine program, the nuclear submarine program, as an example of how to do this right. They do encourage dissent. They want to hear from outlying opinions because it's such a critical mission. And I don't understand why NASA's culture has to go counter to what NASA is advocating to its own employees.
Bob in Tucson sent in a note and said, were you ever officially silenced or given marching orders for how and what to talk about regarding the ESA's architecture or any related program while you were at Johnson?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I mean, there were, and this isn't NASA's fault. This is just the company I was working for did not want me promulgating other ideas on architecture, and I had ones other than lunar surface rendezvous. simply because they thought I was reinventing physics, you know, how lawyers can get sometimes very protective of intellectual property. And then there was also the fear of offending the customer, which is all too real, I'm afraid, under the culture we're talking about. So there's no doubt that I would not be here today if I weren't unemployed. Retired.
Well, hopefully your retirement checks will still continue to come in.
Yeah.
Where if they hear about this, maybe they'll find a loophole in the law to silence your retirement checks, right?
Well, that would be unfortunate because I'm not sure I'd really want to go back. I really need this change to explore some new concepts in research.
Stay right there, everybody. We'll be back with our final segment with Dan in about 2 minutes. Don't go anyplace.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible. The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to the Friday Space Show. I'm your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Dan Adamo. We're talking about a lunar surface rendezvous mission, which is quite different from the way NASA is currently planning to take us back to the moon. Dan, during the break, you pointed out that there might be a that there is an important environmental issue when we continue slamming our hardware into the surface of the moon. So can you discuss that with us? We've really not had this issue talked about before on the Space Show.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, I'm a sort of a green kind of guy in space, too. It's certainly something we ought to consider. Under the current lunar architecture, we would on every mission after the ascent stage has brought the crew back from the moon into low lunar orbit and transferred the crew into the crew exploration vehicle. The plan is to undock the uncrewed ascent stage and then using leftover propellant that you'd have to budget for, you would then target impact on the lunar surface with a rather small burn. It's probably on the order of tens of meters per second. Then dispose of the ascent stage in that manner. However, if you wound up with not having that propellant available, then the lunar mass concentrations would perturb the ascent stage into an impact anyway. It just would be, you wouldn't know where it would occur. Somewhere under the ground track is about all you can say, sort of like what we see with these re-entering vehicles in Earth orbit. You might have infrastructure on the moon that is under that ground track. It's not very likely it would get hit, but the fact remains that it's not a good plan from that standpoint. It's also not a good plan from the scientific standpoint long term, because any residual propellant in that state, some of it's toxic, is going to get spread all over the moon to contaminate otherwise pristine surface samples, and who knows what else to the residual atmosphere of the moon. And finally, it's just a waste of resources. I mean, this is, other than the crew module itself, the ascent stage is probably the most expensive piece of hardware per kilogram that exists in the Constellation program. And you have to throw it away after during every mission, and it has all these expensive systems in it that you fabricated, including crew life support, avionics, computers, all that stuff.
But you realize that if you don't slam this stuff into the moon, you have severely limited the private sector's eBay market when private people get to the moon.
Well, under the Lunar Surface Rendezvous architecture, you would have all this hardware intact instead of
higher price.
Hypervelocity impact.
Well, yeah, but probably the government would claim still ownership of that.
That's right.
You know, there really is no salvage law for space. Like there is for the sea and for other areas. This has come up on a lot of space attorney legal shows, and many attorneys have advocated sort of a law of the sea salvage set of laws for space, too, because they actually look down the road into the future and can see the possibility of salvaging a sick satellite or a defunct satellite and getting it to work again, and then who really owns it. Or taking something off the moon, you know, get Timothy Leary or Gene Roddenberry's ashes and selling them on eBay.
Or part of the Eagle's descent stage.
You know, or absolutely. On the serious side, how does NASA address or have an awareness or deal with the environmental, or to use the color coding green issue that you've just talked about?
You know, it's very interesting when it involves the Earth. They bend over backwards. I mean, environmental impact studies and any assessments that are necessary involving toxic propellant and post-Columbia efforts that were inaugurated to make sure that the civilian population is safe from any orbiter that might be disabled. All that is very well addressed, in my opinion, by NASA. But for some reason, when you get out into deep space, it's just the Wild West. Nobody seems too concerned. Now, you know, if it's a matter of life and death, I can sort of understand that. You know, you crash something into the moon, it meant you saved the crew, certainly, but this is the normal plan. You just do it every time, and after a while, particularly if you're talking about missions that tend to be similar, you know, they're doing logistics to a base, let's say, and they use pretty much the same ground track kind of design for their trajectory. After a while, you could have quite a graveyard up there.
And the same thing would go for slamming equipment on an EO or on Mars as well, right?
Right.
So the systems developed for the moon certainly have a direct comparison to how we're going to treat the surface of an EO or Mars whenever we get there.
Yeah, I guess with Mars, the possibility of life has led to some consideration of on NASA's part and probably other space agencies that have sent vehicles there to really doing a good job sterilizing their spacecraft. But in terms of avoiding impact on Mars after the mission is over, nobody budgets propellant to do some type of Mars escape burn that sends the vehicle out into solar orbit again. They just let whatever happens happen. It's sort of sad, but you know, we are stretching our capability somewhat. I just don't think that this is something we ought to long-term be doing on the moon, which is really in our backyard.
And we have the capability in your plan or something like it to avoid this problem right now.
That's right. I mean, sometimes you do want to do impacts to a limited degree. Maybe you're trying to obtain seismic data from the moon, and maybe there's some kind of program that on a limited basis does a systematic series of impacts of, let's say, an Earth departure stage on a few missions after you've established a seismic network to get a lot of information on the moon. But we know from telescopic campaigns that the moon suffers impacts all the time, and I think that was also borne out in the Apollo program. So the natural way will get you that information, I think, eventually. Under the Lunar Surface Rendezvous architecture, there are no impacts necessary. Everything's just left on the moon or blasts off from the moon and leaves.
George in Los Angeles says, when you talk about Lunar Surface Rendezvous with your peers, does this environmental component of it raise any eyebrows? Is it part of the discussion, or is it glossed over?
Well, you know, it's amazing the spectrum of political and environmental personalities you encounter in the space program. We're all united with our interest in space exploration, but there's some people that are tree huggers and other people that aren't. I can remember on console and mission control, you know, you're there for 8 hours, maybe more, at a stretch, and very little time to head outside, and food gets brought in at the start of the shift, and it's amazing the number of people that don't even care to try to recycle their soda cans. And then there's other people that do it religiously. There's receptacles all over the building in which to recycle those cans, but some people just refuse to.
Fascinating. So I guess it shouldn't be any different than anything else.
That's right. We're just people like anyone else. Yep. And, there's some concern I have there. I don't think it's generally shared.
If we're looking at redesigning the vision for space exploration with the new administration, were they to say, let's omit the moon altogether, we've been there, done that, let's do a NEO and then go on to Mars, is that something you would be supportive of?
Well, as a astrodynamicist, I'd have some regrets about it, I tell you, because the moon is a very interesting problem in my field. But at the same time, if the only game in town was going to near-Earth asteroids, there are some very interesting aspects to that problem as well. So I wouldn't feel cheated in the least with any destination beyond low Earth orbit. I'd be happy to support any way I could sending humans to those kinds of destinations.
What about, and this is just me speaking off the top of my head, because we're always talking about we got to do something more than go to low Earth orbit. What if we had a habitat or a mini station in geosynchronous or some other orbit, and we learn how to deal with radiation and live and cope in that kind of an orbit rather than LEO, but we're still not off to a NEO or to the moon? Is there any value to doing something like that?
Well, there's certainly more value to it than just staying in low Earth orbit and speculating and extrapolating. Of course, you could also gather information without humans at all, just have really good radiation detectors on robotic vehicles in all kinds of different orbits. So I hate to say there's no value in anything outside of LEO, even if it doesn't go to the moon. But by the time you get to geosynchronous orbit, my golly, you spend an awful lot of what you need to get to the moon. You think about it, going to geosynchronous altitude,
well, you're only
and circularizing, you've probably spent more propellant than a translunar injection boat. So you're awful far down the road toward certainly going to a near-Earth object and all that. Near-Earth objects are fascinating dynamically in the sense that the mission really doesn't need as much propellant to reach them, stop, and come back as they do to land on the moon, because the moon, you're digging yourself down into a gravity potential well that you have to then leave. The NEOs that we're considering certainly so small that it's really a microgravity environment, very much like the space station. So you're doing a rendezvous, not a landing. You're doing a rendezvous and maybe a grapple of the Neo when you arrive. And so the propellant costs are actually less, particularly if you're willing to take your time and not use the warp drive to get out there in 2 minutes and stop.
If we adopted lunar rendezvous and that was the plan and we were adequately funded, what is the time frame needed to return us to the moon?
Well, really, I can't imagine getting to the moon. You're talking after a NEO mission?
No, instead of going first.
Okay.
But we've adopted your program. We're not going to have Ares 1. We're going to go straight to the kind of program you're talking about in your papers. And that decision is made right now, January 2nd, 2009. And they're adequately funded, whatever that means. I don't know what that means, but whatever it means, it means. What's the soonest do you think that we could get back to the moon?
That's why I notionally selected 2019. I mean, for this example, illustrative mission. I don't see any problem in doing it in less than 10 years.
But this is still longer than it took us to get to the moon with no technology.
Exactly. Now, we have adequate funding, I think is the word you used. We don't have crash program funding like we did in Apollo. So I think that's probably the big difference, is that because we are in a crash program, we don't have unlimited funding, access to all intellectual resources that the nation can muster, including military ones. I think 10 years is probably a reasonable estimate, given that you only have to develop one launch vehicle. You don't have to develop anything but a descent stage in addition to the CEV. I think that saves you a lot. It gives you a lot of schedule margin. Of course, there are the problems associated with the Ares 5 as it's currently envisioned. That's a pretty sizable vehicle, but it's not a Nova, to harken back to the 1960s when we were considering direct ascent. It's not a Nova, but it's more than a Saturn V, and we may have some infrastructure issues on that, but it's important to distinguish between those infrastructure issues and the architecture issues I'm raising. Infrastructure issues are just a matter of money. You can just build a building that big with a floor that strong and a, crawler transporter that can hold that weight. If you're talking architecture issues, you're talking about putting crews in danger when they may not need to be, and being unable to reach the areas that you originally said you wanted to on the moon. I mean, those are physics issues, whereas infrastructure isn't a physics issue. It's more a dollars issue.
What would it take, in your opinion, for the Return to the Moon program to become the kind of crash program national priority that we had with Apollo? Is there any chance of that happening? Could anything be a catalyst to create that kind of push for getting back to the moon?
Well, it would sort of be a sad tale in a way, because I don't think, certainly Kennedy, from what I can tell from reading from folks like Dr. Lanius, Kennedy really didn't want a space race. He wanted a cooperative program if he could possibly negotiate it. So it'd sort of be a sad tale in that we start another space race, but certainly that's one way it could turn things into a crash program. You probably need more than just China saying, we're going to get to the moon first to induce us into a crash program. They'd have to be belligerent about it for some reason, too, say, well, we're going to rain destruction down on you from the moon and create all the kind of hysteria that really was more or less prevalent in political circles as the space age dawned. I don't think that's in the offing. I sure hope it isn't. But it would take something like that, I think, to start another crash program. It would have to be a space race kind of thing.
Linda in Austin, Texas says, one thing you haven't talked about is the cost that the United States is expending to maintain the International Space Station. if we're talking about getting more funding into whatever program is going to be used to take us to the moon, should we keep the International Space Station going, or could we scrap that and use that money in a better way to take us back to the moon, for example?
Well, we could certainly do that, Linda, but we'd be saving an awfully small amount of money, given, you know, the station's almost constructed. In fact, what we haven't put up there, it's already been built, paid for. You're just talking about it, saving maybe a few shuttle missions, and of course that's been the plan all along, is to shut the shuttle down and use the money we spend for shuttle to fund deep space exploration. So in terms of our ongoing money to operate the space station, that is a drop in the bucket compared to the dollars required to get to the moon. And then potentially you have all the benefits that the space station offers to the deep space exploration effort in terms of having humans to study the effects of microgravity on the operations experience with other countries, which almost certainly will be what will be required to get out into the solar system, as opposed to a competitive space race. I think the real future in the international arena in space exploration is a cooperative one, and space station keeps our hand in that game.
If Lunar Rendezvous were going to be an international program with China and other players, then you wouldn't have any problem in that.
Oh, no, certainly not. I really think the only mistake I think this country has made in international cooperation is letting other countries get onto the critical path. You know, if we're really even just a co-leader, then we need to make sure that the critical elements involved in exploration are directly under control. You know, if we want the Canadians to build a robotic system to assist in something on the lunar surface, like consumables transfer, more power to them. But at the same time, we don't want to go off to China and say, and you're going to build the descent module that we depend on every time we land. I don't think we want to do that, but that's my opinion.
You have to have some big changes in the ITAR rules in order to allow this anyway.
Well, I guess. And that's true of Space Station today. And that's, again, why it's good to keep the station going, because it raises these kinds of issues and it forces us to deal with them. I hope to see some improvement in ITAR. I mean, there was a time when we were fearful we wouldn't be able to coordinate International Space Station maneuvers with the Russians because of ITAR. Now, fortunately, sensible people got involved and put that issue to rest. But if you extrapolated what ITAR was saying, that was one of the kinds of things in my little microcosm that I was having to deal with, fortunately not for a very long period of time.
I think we probably have time for this one last question. This is Henry in Atlanta. Going back to some of the other things that you've discussed on this show, I fail to see why Griffin or anyone at NASA would not heed the CAIB report and would close off NASA to input and feedback in their systems management and development. What is to be gained? And furthermore, if they do have an accident or something happens, they're going to be held up to the light of day of the CAIB report and shown that these people went directly against the recommendations and closed the system off. Why would any educated person do this?
I can't imagine why, and I have great respect for Dr. Griffin's technical expertise. That kind of expertise belongs in the NASA administrator position, in my opinion. I just can't understand why he's gone against the culture that I believe NASA ought to have. And maybe I'm getting the story wrong. Maybe he just has bad press. But that's what I keep hearing over and over again, is that debate is being stifled. And even if I'm wrong, I think it's important to remember that lesson learned from the Columbia investigation and keep holding it up and keep NASA's direction toward free and open debate about things like lunar exploration architecture.
Well, I'll put the offer out again to Dr. Griffin or anyone at NASA who wants to come on the show and clarify and tell us that what we've assumed here is not, in fact, an assumption, in fact, and that NASA does have a wide-open feedback process. If you want to do that, or if you can do that, or if Dr. Griffin ever finds out about these shows, because this issue has come up on many different programs, I would be more than happy to devote as many space show programs as NASA would like to, be able to tell the NASA story correctly and appropriately, without a filter of the New York Times or Space Florida or, space.com or whatever that filter might be. So you all know how to contact me, and just drspace@thespaceshow.com. And I would welcome that opportunity to have NASA people come on and talk to us. And so far, I've never heard from anybody, but there's always a first time, right?
Yes, indeed. I'm sure I'd be listening if a show like that came up.
So just to repeat, I have a couple of your papers. One is the overview of an illustrative lunar surface rendezvous mission, and the other is your white paper, which is titled Revisited Virtues of Lunar Surface Rendezvous with a One-Page Executive Summary. That I can send to people upon request, or they can contact you directly at your email address, and you'll be happy to send it. And you're at adamod@earthlink.net, correct?
That is correct, and that email address is also in both papers.
Listeners don't ever get off the show without leaving us, I don't mean listeners, I mean guests, never get off the show without leaving us with pearls of wisdom that survive, time, because these shows are from 2001 are still listened to. What would you like to say to us? What are your concluding remarks for today?
Well, just that I hope people will critically looking at lunar surface rendezvous as an alternative. It may not be ultimately what we elect to implement for lunar exploration architecture, but I'd love to hear from anyone with an opinion on that, particularly if it's based on a review of my paper or something in the paper that's missing that they know about. These papers are living documents. In fact, I need to send you a revision to the white paper that I came up with last night, David, because I found out the descent stage on the current lunar surface access module is indeed using cryogenic propellant. I had incorrectly stated that it wasn't. So these are living documents, and I want to make them as correct as possible with regard to real physics.
Okay, and then I guess for anyone who may be associated with or is a great believer in the direct-to approach, contact Dan and see why your direct-to approach is still preferable over to what he is talking about. I suspect that as long as you're doing it the NASA way, direct-to makes a lot of sense. But as soon as you go into LSR, as Dan has been suggesting, then the first part of Direct-To doesn't make sense because it's not necessary.
Well, and certainly Direct-To is a scalable, uses scalable boosters that eventually you could get into a lunar surface rendezvous architecture, as the proposal does advocate at one point.
Ben, in Oklahoma City, one last note for you. Have you had any opportunity to submit your white paper to the Obama Space Transition Team? Are you interested in doing that? I see they've been submitted with space solar power and other documents. Why not this?
Well, I did do that, I believe, on or about the 12th of December. Unfortunately, I caught him going on vacation, I think.
Well, did they still get it?
I don't get confirmation when I submit something, so I don't know if they got it, but there's every indication that they got it. It just may be that because of the vacation in Hawaii and other staff being on vacation that they haven't been able to post it yet. As of last night, I looked and they had not yet posted.
This was on change.gov is where they posted it?
That's correct. Your seat at the table.
And if we wanted to find it, what do you think, what would be the category? How would they post it?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know exactly how they would post it, but I'm sure something to the effect of Lunar Surface Rendezvous would probably trip across it. You don't want to use any acronyms, but Lunar Surface Rendezvous might do it.
Because I know when the Space Solar Power thing got posted, I got emails with the URL from Space Frontier Foundation and National Space Society. So we were told where to go to find it.
I would be glad to do likewise when I see it posted.
So if you see it posted and you send me the URL, I'll make it available and announce it on the air.
Thanks very much, David.
Dan, we will be in touch and stay up on this with you. And I think it's a really constructive and a great idea and deserves to be right up there with the top consideration and merit for how we get back to the moon.
Well, thank you very much.
And I'm sure we'll be in touch. So thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure.
And listeners, that's it. And Rand Simberg is our guest coming back on Sunday. So don't miss that show. Thank you all, and goodbye from the Space Show.